This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The record you're about to hear is the very first record made by Gladys Knight and the Pips. The man you're about to meet produced this and many other R&B, blues, doo-wop, and rap records.
In every beat of my heart, there's a beat for you.
Bobby Robinson produced Every Beat of My Heart in 1961. Robinson is one of the first African Americans to own his own record label. Actually, he's owned several: Robin, Fire, Fury, and Enjoy Records. There's a new box set of his records from the 50s and 60s. It features talent he discovered, like Gladys Knight, and performers he brought out of retirement, like Arthur Crudup, who wrote one of Elvis's early hits. When Robinson tracked Crudup down to record that song, Crudup was a migrant worker.
Well, now, that's all right now, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, baby. Any way you do now, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right now, Mama. Any way you do.
Bobby Robinson recorded bluesman Lightnin' Hopkins' biggest hit, Mojo Hand. And in that same session, they made this.
Me glory be, me glory be, yeah. You know somebody been talking about me. Whoa, Miss Glory B, Miss Glory B. You know somebody been talking about poor me.
Also featured on the new box set are some of Robinson's hits like Wilbert Harrison's Kansas City, Lee Dorsey's Ya Ya, Elmore James's Dust My Broom, King Curtis's Soul Twist, as well as recordings by more obscure blues and R&B performers. Bobby Robinson got his start in the music industry in 1946 when he opened a record store, which he still owns, in Harlem, just a few blocks away from the Apollo Theater. He told me what records he was selling back then.
Well, I started off basically with the trend of black records. It was a whole new thing. The doo-wop thing came in about 48 or 49, and I just had opened a store, so I got right into that. During the period of the early 50s, I developed 13 doo-wop groups. I had 13 groups, and then I got into blues, rhythm and blues, and the first one thing and another, but I concentrated on rhythm and blues mostly. That was my forte, and I grew up with it. As the new artists came aboard and rhythm and blues began to catch on and became popular for the first time, then I was right on the trend with it, and I produced some of the early things that caught on. So I grew up with rhythm and blues more or less.
Well, let me ask you this. At what point in your career as a record store owner did you say to yourself, I want to make records too?
Well, I tell you, I was one half a block from the Apollo Theater. And as I went, I met a lot of artists from all over the country. In fact, nobody would dare come to the Apollo Theater, come in town, an artist that had a record, without stopping by to see me. Everybody would tell them, if you want to know what's happening with your record in New York, you go by to Bobby Robinson. You better go stop by Bobby's place and find out what's happening with your record. So everybody came. I had a stream of guys just coming in every week. So it dawned on me that customers were coming to me, people out of the streets, and the entertainers were coming to me. Everybody coming to me wanted to know what about their records, what was happening, what was good, should they do this or that, this or that. So I was giving out advice and whatnot. So it dawned on me. So I said, well, if I'm such an authority on this music, I better get into it. So finally, I made up my mind, and I just went in and I started to rehearse some groups, local groups, at night. I closed the store at 11 o'clock, and from 11 to 12 or so, I'd lock the doors and let the groups come right in and rehearse right in the store. So finally, I decided on a couple of groups, and I took them down to the studio and recorded them.
Let me skip ahead to 1959, the year that you had a record that made it to number one on the pop chart and on the R&B chart. And the record, of course, was Kansas City, sung by Wilbert Harrison.
Yeah.
How did you release this record?
Well, Wilbert Harrison came to me one day, and he said he'd had one record out in about 54 or 55 with Savoy Records that did pretty good. You know, it wasn't a national hit, but he did pretty fair. For some reason, Savoy was into a lot of jazz and whatnot, so he didn't record Wilbert again. And Harrison had kept complaining to them about he wanted to put a record on the record. So he made himself a nuisance, evidently, with Savoy Records. And Mr. Lubinsky was the president of Savoy Records. So he got mad one evening and got his gun out of his drawer there and drew it on Harrison and told him not to darken his door again, to go and record for whoever he wanted to record. Just get out of there and not come back. So Harrison came to me thinking that, you know, the man meant what he said, and he did mean what he said then, but he had 3 months to go on a 5-year contract. And Harrison didn't think to say, well, give me a release or anything like that, and the guy didn't think about it. He was just finished with Harrison, and Harrison was, well, that was it. He was finished with him. So he came to me, and he told me, he said, I've been doing this record, Kansas City. He said, the people where I'm working out in Jersey in this club go for this record. They call for it all night. I have to do a song over and over and over. He said, and I'd like to record it. So I said, all right. Since he was there, I said, tell you what, I have a rehearsal this afternoon, and I have some of my boys there. So come on down and let me hear exactly what the song is like and let the group hear it, and let's see if we can get a thing on it. And, you know, so we went out to this place, and he sat down at the piano. He played piano, too. So he sat down at the piano and started to do the song. And I had about 4 or 5 pieces of the band there, and I had the boys to come in behind me. And we got such a terrific sound that I got very excited, and I called the studio and set a session for the next day to record this song.
Let's hear your 1959 recording, Kansas City. Now, the story with Savoy, what happened, since he was still officially under contract with him, although you didn't realize that, did they sue you afterwards when the record came out?
Only $1 million.
Only $1 million,
That's all.
So you had this number one hit, and you didn't get to really profit from it in the way you
wanted. Well, I profited from it because I won the case. It was a long battle. The record was an instant hit, and what happened was, it's the funniest thing, I when I recorded it, I went to my shop and played it that night, and everybody gathered around the door, and, you know, but I didn't realize how big it was, how important it was. You know, everybody just liked it. So what I did, I had about a dozen metal demos made up, and I got in the car, my partner and I, and we went on a leisurely trip. We went to Philadelphia, to Pittsburgh, to Cleveland, to Detroit, and we'd stop and put it on station wherever we went. So it was going all together about 10 days. And we got back on Sunday, and this was late March, and it was raining and whatnot, and I caught a cold. So we got back in the afternoon about 2 o'clock, so I went by my office, which I had locked up when I left, and we had a slot in the door for mail and whatnot. So I went back and just to check to see if I had any mail. I didn't know the record was a hit. I didn't know anything about it because we hadn't spoke to anybody. And so when I went to unlock the door, it made a big noise, and I pushed, and it was kind of heavy. I didn't know what the hell was going on. So I pushed the door open and looked behind it, and I had a barrel of telegrams. I must have had 200 telegrams just pile up in the middle of the floor. So I didn't know what it was all about. Started to shut the door and go back. So anyway, I picked up a telegram and I found out I had to smash it. Everybody was calling me going crazy, you know.
My guest is record producer Bobby Robinson. There's a new CD box set of recordings on his Fire and Fury record labels. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is record producer Bobby Robinson, one of the first African-Americans to own his own record label. So what was it like for you to promote the records that you were producing back in the 1950s and the early 1960s? Would you go around the country in your car and play them for disc jockeys around the country?
Yeah, I'd go one way or the other. I'd get to New Orleans. I'd get a plane mostly because it was a long drive. And I'd go to New Orleans and I'd hit the station and I'd go hang out with the jockeys and I'd sit up and they'd play records. We'd laugh and talk and interview me and whatnot. And I had a distributor there. And I'd break records. I'd go into Atlanta and to Miami and wherever, Nashville, and just that way, one by one, step by step, until we got established. And I kept coming with hits, and so everybody just had to have the records after a while. And the first thing I know, I was in the record business.
Did any of the disc jockeys expect certain favors from you to play the records?
Yeah, that went on. That got to be a big thing in the 50s. And
what did you have to give them?
Well, what it depended on who the jockey was and whatnot. A lot of jockeys wanted, they wanted me to give them a deal on the jockey to come in to do a show. They figured that way they didn't take any money from me directly, and it was much more important if I did it. But yeah, to have an artist that everybody's calling for to go in and do shows for nothing for jockeys was an easy job. After all, the artists wanted to make money too.
So disc jockeys hoped that you'd have your performer do a free show for
them.
Yeah,
if your performer got hot, you got a record out and the record got hot, then right away, disc jockeys, where they would avoid maybe being investigated or whatnot, they want you to give them the artist free. You know, they would pay their fare in and whatnot. And they come in and do a free show, and they didn't care if they do one song. They do the hit song. That's all they had to do, one song. And he said they can go back, you know. So a lot of that was going on, you know. It took a lot of hassling here and there and a lot of, you know. But I worked it which way I could.
Did you ever have to pay to get airplay?
Oh, I have, yeah. Oh, I played a lot of guys to get airplay. But, you know, I kept coming with hits, and I worked with artists is much, much more than the average company that didn't have hits.
Being a black record producer, was it more difficult for you to get your records played on white stations, records that you thought could cross over into white stations?
Well, yeah, it was just, it was impossible. You couldn't get into that group pop stations. White stations just wouldn't play the records unless they were forced to play them, you know. And I came up once in a while with strong things that were so strong that they just had to play them. So the audience demanded it. And Kansas City really opened the door for me in 59 because everybody played it. Everybody had to play it. It was number one for about 10 weeks.
Now, you've recorded a lot of blues-based music over the years. I want to play something that's one of my favorite recordings on the new Fire Fury box set anthology. And this is Tar Heel Slim and Little Ann, and it's a 1959 recording called Much Too Late.
I was wrong, Little Ann, when I drove you from my door. I was wrong, Little Ann, when I drove you from my door. 'Cause the girl I thought that loved me
Tar Heel Slim. He was an old friend of yours?
Yeah. Tar Heel Slim was his name was Alan Bunn, and he was with, he came to New York with a group out of North Carolina, a gospel group. And he was a good writer himself. He's a guitarist, and he sang and wrote a couple of things. So he came to me, he had a few things. So I liked his ideas, and so I got together and recorded him. I had recorded him on one or two things before that record came out. And then with his very first record came out after Kansas City. The next record I put out after Kansas City was Tar Heel Slim and Ann on a thing called It's Too Late. It was also a hit that came out of the woodwork, as they say, and it established them.
Did you grow up with the blues?
Yeah.
In South Carolina?
South Carolina, yeah.
Where did you hear music?
Well, on street corners. There were when I was small, my father would take me into town. We lived 5 miles out of a little town, Union, South Carolina. And on Saturdays, on the street corners, there were men selling household goods, anything, pots and pans and all kind of little items and whatnot. And so he would use a guitar-playing blues singer to draw the crowd. And he would stop the singing, and he would hawk his wares and whatnot. And then he'd let the guy say, just a minute, I'm going to have old Puddle Johnson to do another number for you here, just so-and-so-and-so-and-so. So I was fascinated by this. My father would take me there, and he couldn't go anywhere else. I'd make him stay there with me. and I would listen to this guy sing. You know, they would come on, and they would sing and play the guitar, and it had a big crowd around, you know. And I got fascinated with this music, and every chance I got, I followed guys around like the Pied Piper was leading me. Whoever was some blues singers around, I'd go listen to them, you know.
Did they lead you in places that young people weren't supposed to be?
Yeah, but I had to slip and go. I got a few whippings for going. I used to go to country frolics on Saturday night, and I'd always get a beating. I know it's going to get a beating when I get home. I'd slip off and go with some grown boys, and it was just way out in the country where they sold illegal homemade liquor and had fried chicken and whatnot in the places. They'd take all the beds and clear a whole room, and two guitar players would, this was unamplified guitar, just regular guitar, would get chairs and get in the corner, and they would play, and everybody would dance. And I was just so fascinated with this, I would slip and go. I know it's going to get a whipping when I got home, and I would slip off and go. And everybody got in there and get a couple of sandwiches and get a drink or two, that homemade liquor, and boy, the party was on. I was fascinated.
Let me skip ahead a bunch of years and go up to, I guess, the mid or late 70s when you started recording rap records.
Yeah.
Now, you started off doing doo-wop. You did rhythm and blues and blues. How did you end up recording rap? You were much older than the generation of rappers that you were recording.
Well, rap kind of came about. It started in 76. As a fad, a lot of guys were playing records in the parks and whatnot in the summertime. You know, the cattle would play out, had little dances outside and whatnot, and in the local clubs, and they just started talking, you know, behind the records, they're playing, and just to have something going, they started to rap, and it's a thing that caught on, and I noticed it was getting bigger and bigger, and among the crowds in the Bronx and in Harlem. And so I was in another business. I was in a wholesale business, and I didn't bother much with it. So one night, Sugar Hill,
the record label.
Yeah, the record label. The guy and his wife, Joe and Sylvia Robinson, was at a nightclub in Harlem there. They came down to see somebody. And a couple of kids got up and did a rap thing. They hadn't heard of it before. And she got fascinated with it. She got these guys and went and recorded them. And that was the Sugar Hill Gang. And I got mad with myself. I knew about it the 2-3 years that it had been around, you know, but I never bothered because I wasn't recorded at that time. I was in the wholesale record business. And then she came out of this record, and everybody went crazy. They was grabbing it right and left. So I said, good. You know, I was mad because I wasn't the first because I knew about it. She didn't. So I sent the word out to some disco clubs that was meeting, you know, had the shows on weekends, 2-3 nights on the weekends, whatnot. I contacted disco clubs in Harlem and the Bronx and whatnot and told the guys I was coming around to get the guys together, all the rappers, and let me hear them. So I spent about 3 nights in the Bronx and Harlem listening to this rap and that rap and whatnot. So I picked out 2 groups, the Disco 4 and Grandmaster Flash and the Furious 5.
And they were one of the best groups, Grandmaster Flash. What did you record by Grandmaster Flash?
Super Rapping. A song called Super Rapping. They just one guy after the other took over the rap, you know? And then we had the music going in the background, and the band just kept playing, kept a dance thing going all along, and the guys would take a break and this and the other. So we had 2-3 rehearsals and worked it out. Just a off-the-cuff type of thing, more or less. And it was a smash hit. Sha-la-la!
you gotta see to believe. We're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 MCs. I'm Melly Mel and I'm rocking so well.
And I'm Mr. Ness because I rocks the best.
I'm Raheem, in all the ladies' dreams.
And I'm Cowboy to make you jump for joy.
I'm Creole,
solid gold,
the King Creole,
playing the role.
Dig this with a furious 5+ Grandmaster Flash, giving you a blast, showed up class. So to prove to you all we're second to none,
we're gonna make 5 MCs sound like one.
You gotta dip with the dive,
then so socialize,
clean out your ears
and open your eyes,
and then you pay at the door as a donation
to hear the best sounds in creation.
It's the disco dream
of the mean machine,
and when it cuts the side,
you see what we mean.
You say his name is not found in the Hall of Fame,
but it'll shock and amaze and make you feel shame.
It's a line from 11.
Are you still running your record store in Harlem?
Yeah.
How much time do you spend in the store?
Well, I don't spend much time now. My daughter runs it more or less, my daughter and my nephew. I'm trying to break them in to take care of it. I already have time off. I just go in every day and just check, see if things are all right. But I'm going to take some time and write a book. Everybody's after me about write a book. I made a decision 2 or 3 years ago, but it's been like hanging, and I've been doing a lot of things. So now that I'm more or less free to do it, I'm going to concentrate on writing a book and get it out.
Bobby Robinson, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bobby Robinson is the founder of the Fire and Fury Record Labels. A new box set of reissues called the Fire Fury Records Story has just been released by Capricorn Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.